Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Shabbat Shalom. I just want to acknowledge that we're on the Shabbat before Christmas, which is kind of an interesting way of looking at it. And Christmas is an interesting time for us Messianic Jews. It's become one of the borderlines between Christianity and Judaism culturally. And it's blurred in sometimes uncomfortable ways by the mench on a bench and the Hanukkah bush. I don't know if you guys have heard. You know, we try to bring these things together, but of course they're totally different times. You know, they're about totally different themes. But socially, Christmas has become entirely non-Jewish. And so it's interesting that we actually connect in some ways more with our people by joining them for Chinese food in a movie than, you know, any other way. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. But I think it's a good thing that Christians come around the globe to celebrate the birth of our Messiah. It's a wonderful thing. And we really support that, to celebrate God coming among us in this world. And for us Messianic Jews, remembering the birth of our Messiah is like, it could be like the quintessential Jewish day. You know, I mean, it's really important. So we've long needed a Jewish way to remember Yeshua's birth. So we've been working on this over the past few years. I've been announcing it and whatnot. But tonight, at the conclusion of Shabbat, Motzi Shabbat, we'll have our first community, Zikaron Emmanuel, a Seder to remember the birth of our Messiah. We're really excited about it. It's modeled after the Passover Seder. We have four cups, the cup of Elishava and Zechariah, the cup of Miriam and Joseph, the cup of Emmanuel, the cup of Hazikaron. We use different elements to retell the birth story together, and it's just a wonderful thing. And it's really cool, and we feel like we're making Messianic Jewish history here. So that's all by way of introduction. But in light of Yeshua's birth, Paul says in Galatians, God sent his son born of a woman in the fullness of time. And then we read in our Besorah passage today how God sent his son to dwell, to be among us, his logos, his word, to become flesh. Today what I want to do is take a look at a prophecy in Daniel 9, which I believe foretells the time period and perhaps the even exact year that Yeshua would come. And it's really neat. So when we're talking about, you know, him coming, it's like, let's look at this. There are so many different prophecies. What happens is, when you look at some of the prophetic pictures in the Bible, it comes alive. But I want to focus in on this one here. Now, this timeline looks complicated. You don't have to read it. It's okay. I wanted you to see this is the whole prophecy broken down. And we're going to walk through it piece by piece. But there's a lot to this prophecy. So my intention is to try to make this clear as we possibly can. But it is a little bit complicated. So bear with me. And if you don't get something, raise your hand. Okay? So let me give you first an overview of the book of Daniel. Daniel claims to be written by Daniel himself during the Babylonian exile. According to the first verse, Daniel was exiled to Babylon around 605 BCE. Now, Daniel is the first to go of his people, and this begins an exile period that goes for 18 years. Now, let me just explain for anyone it's a little bit unclear. BCE refers to before Common Era. Other BC, before Christ, is another way of doing it, but it's become common to use before Common Era. So that's what I'll be doing here. Now, in BCE, we're counting down. So a lower number means earlier, and a higher number means higher. Forgive me if this is true, if you get this, but when it's confusing to me. When you get to CE, Common Era, then it's going up. Okay, so older, newer. Now, what happens is 18 years later, 587, the Babylonians sack Jerusalem again. So they come twice, and they destroy the temple this time, and they send the rest of the people who survived to exile in Babylon. That's the great Babylonian exile. But Daniel went 18 years earlier. Around 49 or 50 years later, in 538 BC, King Cyrus of Persia takes Babylon, and then he allows the Jews to return to the land and begin to rebuild their temple. Israel was back in the land, but they were still occupied territory from then on. Okay, so now Persia comes over, they go out. Now, Daniel was a young man when he went to Babylon, and he stayed there 70 years, the entire 70 years of the exile. And he's writing his prophecy sometime while he's in Babylon and just before the Jews were allowed to return. In the beginning of Daniel's prophecy in Daniel 9:1, he says that he was aware of a prophecy in the book of Jeremiah that there would be 70 years of exile. And so I think it's likely that he began pleading with God to hasten to bring about this exile and this return as the 70 years was drawing to a close. So let's approximately say that Daniel did his prophecy 539 BCE, a year or so before the 70 years was going to come up. Now, sum up these dates. Babylonian comes, first Jerusalem siege, Daniel's exiled 605. 18 years later, 587, Babylon attacks again. The big exile happens. The Jerusalem temple is destroyed. 539, we're suggesting Daniel receives his prophecy we're about to read. And then a year or so later, Cyrus allows the Jews to go back to Jerusalem, beginning the fulfillment of this prophecy. Let's get into this prophecy and see what it looks like. Now, I just want to say, I spent a lot of time going through this prophecy, like looking at the different interpretations and how different groups of Jewish people and Christians understand it. Because of time, I can't go through each one because it'd be a two-hour seminar. But what I'm going to do today is share with you what I think works the best. And then you can talk with me afterwards if you have questions about some other interpretations. But I think this is the most compelling view. Now, Daniel's praying about Jeremiah's prophecy in the exile that would end after 70 years. And so he says this: "While I was still in prayer, Gabriel, the angel, the man I had seen in the earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening offering. He instructed me and said to me, 'Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you begin to pray, a word went out, which I have come to tell you. For you are highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision.'" And here's the beginning of the vision. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city. 70 weeks to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Holy of Holies. So these are the things that need to occur within this time period. And we're going to come back to these points. Now, what's important here is that a week is not a seven-day period. This is universally accepted by scholars about this prophecy, but it refers to a seven-year period, a sabbatical year period. The Hebrew Shavuim, Shavim, it might be better translated 70 sevens, or 70 units of seven. The seven-year week, again, comes from the sabbatical year when we're told to let the land rest, let servants go free, release debts, etc., etc. So it makes sense that that would connect to it. Now, 77-year periods equals a total of 490 years. So that's what we're talking about, 490 years to finish transgression, make an end to sin, make atonement for iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Holy of Holies. Okay, let's go into the next section there. From the issuing of some decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem after the exile until the coming of the Messiah, we'll have 7 units of 7 years. That's 49 years. The verse up at the top is, "So you know and understand that from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the time of Mashiach, the prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So we have 7 units of 7, which is 49 years, and then we have 62 units of 7 years, which is 432 years. Those two together equals 483 years, or 69 sevens. The next part of the verse goes on. "It," referring to the temple, "will be built again with a plaza and a moat, even in times of distress." Now, what happens here is that the 49 years, we wonder, why is it broken into two different parts, 49 and then 62? Why not just the full part? I think it has to do with the 49 years are the time of building. It will be built with a plaza and a moat, even in times of distress. And now, we know that there was extensive plaza and an aqueduct system that was built in the Second Temple during this time. So that happened. That's already happened. And then the following 62 years here, we know were a time of distress in the Second Temple period. So we were never fully back in the land, and we were always occupied. You know, we think of Esther and the Persians. We think of Hanukkah and the Maccabees. We think of Rome in the time of Yeshua. Now, the prophecy goes on, and this is really cool. "Then after the 62 weeks, Mashiach will be cut off and have nothing." Now, the word cut off in Hebrew, karat, can mean killed, it can mean destroyed, but it also has a connotation of being cut off specifically because of sin, a sacrificial kind of connotation. And given the first part of the prophecy, which emphasizes the atonement of sin, I believe that Daniel is actually giving a prophecy about when the Messiah would take on the sins of Israel and the world as if it were his own and then to be killed. Now, the third part here is that the temple destruction. It says, then the people of another prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come with a flood. Until the end of war that is decreed, there will be destruction. So, according to the prophecy, we have a Messiah who will come, who will be cut off, and then the city and the temple will be destroyed by an evil prince. That's the prophetic picture. Now, most commentators, both Christian and Jewish today, interpret this prince to be the Roman Empire, and more specifically, Titus under Rome, who actually destroyed the second temple. So, if you go back to the traditional interpretations of this passage, in Judaism, it's about Titus, who comes to destroy the temple beforehand, and then the anointed one is a figure that's discussed. In sum, we have a rebuilding of the temple with an aqueduct system in a time of distress. A Messiah would come and be cut off within 483 years after some decree to rebuild Jerusalem. The Messiah needs to have something to do with atonement for sin after the Messiah is cut off and the temple is destroyed. Now let's see if this prophecy actually happened within the right time frame. A Messiah would be cut off in 483 years after a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. So we need to look into this decree. What is this decree? Now, moving back after the exile was a long process, and we actually have several decrees in the Bible of various kinds that speak about rebuilding the temple and rebuilding Jerusalem. But remember, we're looking for a decree not just to end the exile and restore the temple, but also rebuild Jerusalem as well. And although the other decrees brought Jews back into the land, they did not kickstart a massive building project. But in 445 BCE, King Artaxerxes makes a decree that we read about in the beginning of the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is the king's cupbearer. And what happens is he appeals to the king that all the Jews are back in the land. We're going back, but Jerusalem is still in ruins. And Nehemiah is still mourning over Jerusalem. The king gives permission to Nehemiah to travel safely to Jerusalem, and he gives him building supplies. So Nehemiah goes back to Jerusalem, and even though enemies surround him, they undertake a massive building project that takes us through the entire book of Nehemiah. And then it culminates with the public reading of Torah to all the people and the dedication of the city wall. That sounds like a good decree to go by. So let's try it. Go back into our timeline here, 445, but let's pay attention to this prophecy does not actually say 483 years. Instead, it says 69 sets of 7 years. I want to suggest that these refer to sabbatical cycles rather than specific years. Let me explain. If we're talking about a 7-day week and we say something happened last week, we don't necessarily mean that it happened on the first day of the week, do we? It could have happened at any time. It could have happened on Wednesday, and now it's Monday, but we'll still say it happened last week. Similarly, a sabbatical cycle is like a week of 7 years. So for our 445 date, the first sabbatical year, the beginning of the week, began on 450 BCE and ended 7 years later on 443 BCE. So this decree in 445 happened in the sixth year of the sabbatical cycle beginning in 450. Think of it as a unit. Now, if we count from the beginning of that sabbatical year, 69 sabbatical year units, then we come to the sabbatical year 27 to 33 CE. So that would mean that according to this prophecy, the Messiah would need to come and then be cut off sometime between 27 CE and 33 CE. Now, the most compelling evidence says that Yeshua was crucified on Passover, April 3rd, 33 CE, year 7, just as the 69th week comes to a close. And in this case, 3 years earlier, Yeshua the Messiah was immersed by Yochanan, beginning his messianic journey right in the heart of the 69th sabbatical year. Then he was killed, he was cut off, atonement was made just before the close of the 69th week after Nehemiah's decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. So Daniel wrote this vision down 571 years before Yeshua came and foretells it to the T, the coming of our Messiah in his atoning death. And I think it's neat that he's cut off just as the week closes. Like the beginning of the prophecy says, sealing up vision and prophecy. Right as this vision comes to a close, it seals, he's cut off. Right there. Now our third part of the prophecy is that after his Messiah is cut off, the temple will be destroyed again. Well, we know that Yeshua himself predicted the destruction of the second temple. And in 70 CE, of course, the temple is completely destroyed by Rome, run by Titus. Now, traditional Jewish commentators, including Rashi, understand this part of the passage to refer to at least the destruction of the second temple. So they say, we don't know who the anointed one is, but we know that this refers to the destruction of the temple in the end. And they debate as to who was cut off. One suggestion that Rashi makes is that maybe it was the high priest who was in power at the time of the temple when it was destroyed. But there are some real problems with this. Aside from the dating issues, which would make it wrong, there's no atonement for sin or anything to do with everlasting righteousness that happened with the destruction of the temple and the death of the high priest. Quite the opposite, it led to the exile. Further, Daniel chapter 7, he's just finished talking about a Mashiach, an anointed one, who would be called the Son of Man, who would judge the nations. This is no ordinary high priest. This is a divine figure. And there's a neat story of a Messianic Jewish scholar named Rachel Friedland, who became a believer in Yeshua, in short, by studying Rashi's commentary on Daniel 29. And to paraphrase, he said that Rashi had the right time frame, but got the wrong anointed one. So if this passage accurately predicted the destruction of the second temple, then we have to take seriously the Messiah figure who was to be cut off, bringing atonement for sin, inauguration of an age of righteousness before the destruction of 70 CE. No one other than Yeshua can fit this picture. Now, to close, remember, Daniel speaks about another week, the full 490 years. And it goes like this, and he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. And in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who destroys, even a complete destruction is poured out onto the one who destroys. Okay, what do we do with this? It sounds very convoluted. Daniel gives us time units. And there are 7 sabbatical weeks, then plus 62 sabbatical weeks. And together they make the Messiah being cut off. Right? Then it simply says, after the Messiah is cut off, the temple will be destroyed, but it doesn't give a specific time frame. And then, as if an afterthought, like a pause, with no mention of the beginning of time, there's a last week of 7 years. The last week sounds just like what we read about in the book of Revelation. The temple is rebuilt again, possibly a third temple. Sacrifices begin again. But then the abomination, the anti-Messiah, if you will, comes midweek and brings complete destruction. But then even the destroyer is destroyed. That's exactly what Daniel just prophesied. That's what Revelation talks about. And this makes sense because Daniel regularly jumps from an event that happens in one time and then parallels that event to something that will happen later at a greater redemption, if you will. And imagine this. Daniel's praying about the 70-year exile to come to an end. And he's expecting some kind of messianic deliverance to happen. But the angel comes to him and says, Daniel, it will not only be 70 years, but 77s of years. It's like he's saying, I'm not only going to tell you about going home, I'm going to tell you the whole complete story all the way to the end. And there will be 7 weeks where the temple and the city will be rebuilt, 62 weeks of distress. At the end of the 69 weeks, 33 CE, the Messiah will have come and will be cut off and will have nothing. Then the temple will be destroyed, but there's still another week to come. And Yeshua taught in parables because he wanted to let those with ears to hear hear. And I think that the nature of prophecy is the same way. It's there for us to see. It's to be a roadmap to point us in the right direction, but also to be veiled a bit so that those with the hearts to see will see. And that's what Yeshua is doing during that pause before the last week. He's winning over the hearts of the Gentiles, and he's winning over the heart of Israel. He's bringing in the kingdom of God one heart at a time, I like to say, until the day that Daniel dreamed of, not only when our Messiah would be cut off, not only would he give us a way back to him, but when the Son of Man, Yeshua, our Messiah, will come again in all of his glory to make things right in our broken world today. And so at this time, as we and our brothers I can say we now because we have our celebration tonight. It's around the globe, we celebrate the birth of our Messiah. Let us be glad. Let us be glad. Daniel told us the exact year of his coming. And like Isaiah said, over 700 years before Yeshua's birth, for to us a son really was born. To us a son was given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. So Shabbat Shalom.
Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those. Oh, know your name and study your Torah. For Messiah.